Well, to help me shape and understand the context of that time, I'm now joined on the line by Henny van Vieren. He is the director of Open Society, or rather Open Secrets, and also the author of Apartheid, Guns and Money. Mr. van Vieren, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Karima, and good evening to listeners.
Now, one of the reasons why I asked you to come on to the program is because in your book, you, of course, do two things. You debunk the myth that corruption started with the advent of democracy in 1994 and that it is only a characteristic of a black majority government. The context in which the National Party ruled, someone as powerful as Magnus Malan, the defense minister, and of course the then Minister of Environmental Affairs, Mr. Wiley, who apparently also committed suicide after reports emerged that they were involved in a pedophile ring. Sketch for us the kind of a grip on power that the National Party government had at the height of apartheid, when of course the beginnings of this investigation was taking root.
Thanks, Karima. You know, I think indeed it's instructive for us not to just compare some of these stories to our experiences today in a democratic system, but to understand that particular context. And it was clearly a system that was built on repression. The apartheid regime only survived because it fostered a culture of secrecy, of withholding access to information to the public, and through brutal repression of ordinary people. And I mean, as we clearly know, and most South Africans have experienced, the kind of repression that limited the opportunities for most South Africans, and black South Africans in particular. But I think it's important for us to recognize the role particularly of the security establishment at the very core of that state. It wasn't by any means an ordinary state. I think when we talk about an undemocratic regime, or some people would call it an autocratic regime, it was a deeply militarized society. And it meant that particularly with the advent of the rise of P.W. Botha from Minister of Defense in the 1970s to become Prime Minister and then ultimately State President of what was then white South Africa in the 1980s. He was a man who was steeped in military thinking. He was very close to the generals and would defer to them for advice and strategy, and their thinking became that which infused the state. Everything, you know, as we recall, became about an onslaught on the state and a total response by the state. That meant the entire economy and society was geared towards a military response against the forces of liberation. And this meant that, and I think it's important to remember this, because it meant that the generals and the securocrats, those bureaucrats of the securocratic tendency, became central cogs in the state machinery, and they were protected by this veil of secrecy. Made people like Magnus Malan, who had been promoted by P.W. Botha as a very rapidly through the military, and had been promoted by Botha as Minister of Defense at quite a young age. It made him an incredibly powerful individual at the center of this very complex network. And I think it's important for us to appreciate that context, because when we talk about someone like Magnus Malan, we're not just talking about a former National Party politician. We are talking in many ways about the most powerful member of the National Party cabinet other than P.W. Botha himself at the time. And I think that's perhaps one of the reasons why, you know, I think there's been such interest in these matters, in addition to the very gruesome and brutal nature of these crimes that are alleged to have been committed. But they also speak to the actions of one of the most powerful leaders of the National Party at the time.
Now, following the news of the death of Mr. Mini, Marianne Tam wrote a piece in the Daily Maverick. She said during her meeting with Mr. Mini last year, he informed her that he feared for his life and that the book would stir a hornet's nest. He also said that those who had done the bidding of the former government were still around and had never been called to account. And here's the thing that points to what you were saying earlier. She said, at the weekend, the Report newspaper confirmed that the former state president, P.W. Botha, had personally called in March 1987 for Minnie's docket relating to Malan, Wiley and Allen to be removed from Minnie's office in PE. A retired colonel who did not wish to be identified confirmed the removal of the docket to the writer Herman Janssen. He said that P.W. Botha had ordered Brigadier Ernie Schnettler, then the divisional commissioner in Port Elizabeth, to get the docket on his desk at 7:30 the following morning. Now, I mean, that is a direct implication. It gives us the idea, the extent to which the rule of law was manipulated, the extent to which the executive actually directly got involved. I mean, this is a state president, commanding that a docket be removed. I mean, are you surprised, Mr. Van Vieren, that Mr. Minnie is in fact dead?
Yeah, Karima, of course, I think like many people, one is saddened not only to see when a writer or an author immediately after publish something like this and is shocked by the fact that, you know, that he's dead. I think there's two things that are crucially important. The first one is just to recognize for us to look at the context, it shouldn't completely surprise us, given the machinations of the apartheid state, the State Security Council, the role that P.W. Botha played at the behest of that, the disappearance and killings of many, many people, that these are just the latest revelations of atrocities, which we've known from about since the 1990s, and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I think, helped us to understand, at least to a greater extent, what some of those were. So I think that Botha was capable of it. He was facing an election that year for the National Party, which was important. This was at the time of the state of emergencies, as we recall what was going on in the country, and he had to retain his grip of power. And a scandal like this could have threatened the National Party were it to have been exposed. And so I think at least it's imaginable that he would definitely have intervened in that way in the interest of his party and given the way that he had conducted himself. But I think secondly, the question around Mr. Minnie's, what has been termed his suicide, if that is what it is, I think given the revelations that he's made, it is certainly deserving of far greater attention, I think, by the police. I think there needs to be a full inquest. I think that the nature of that inquiry needs to be made public on the one hand. But secondly, I think that what we need to understand is how does the National Prosecuting Authority and the Hawks respond to the allegations in a book like this?
Yes.
And I think this is crucial because what we've done, we've come to accept under the leadership of the Sean Abrams and the others within the National Prosecuting Authority, is that impunity is accepted. We hear about the Guptas, we hear about everybody's involvement in crimes, and there's almost a sense that there will be no accountability.
Yes, yes.
We published a book on economic crime during apartheid last year, as you mentioned, Apartheid Guns and Money.
Yes.
Our colleagues and I on Open Secrets researched it. It's an extraordinary tale of international money laundering and crime. I can tell you until this day, we have not
person.
Had any official from the Hawks contact
Absolutely.
Us to ask us about evidence. And
yeah.
That is how impunity is allowed to fester when the state acts in this manner.
I think you're raising something so critical, Mr. Van Vieren. I discussed this last night with former Constitutional Court Justice Johan Krichler about what it says about our criminal justice system. And we tried to trace back, the extent to which how compromised these institutions are, and of course why it's important that these institutions be rebuilt. We know that very few, in fact none of the generals and the apartheid leaders except Adrian Vlok went before the Truth Commission. We know that the economic crimes, the banking sector for example, has never completely explained their role in keeping up a state that was described as a crime against humanity. I mean, your book is a fascinating chronicle of the extent of illegality that was engaged in to prop up the apartheid state. And of course, with the help of governments across the world, including supposedly the the supporters of the anti-apartheid liberation movements at the time, China, former Soviet states that were rerouting guns via the former Zaire and so on to get to the apartheid government. They were an incredibly powerful state, and they built an incredibly powerful edifice through which they could hoodwink even the laws of apartheid. Even though they weren't legitimate, they were even able to undermine those laws in order to prop up the state. And of course, one can imagine that if that is the context, if that is the framework in which you work, if cabinet ministers are involved in a paedophile ring, abusing young coloured boys that they pick up off the streets and abuse on Bird Island, using state helicopters to ferry them there, as described in the book by Mr. Minnie and Mr. Stain, you can imagine that these people believe, probably like the politicians of today believe, that they would their power would last forever and they could act just with impunity.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is no doubt that despite all the warning signs being there that this regime was in peril, the apartheid regime, there was a sense that this battle, this fight could go on for a very long time and lead to a far greater destruction in our country than in fact it did, in terms of the loss of lives and the devastation that the apartheid regime had wreaked. But I think certainly is this question around the complicity of the many officials who stood silent to what was happening. And I'm not trying to make by any means a cheap shot, but I think we need to stand back and ask ourselves, all those ministers from F.W. de Klerk to Baron du Plessis as Minister of Finance and many others who argue that it was all the crimes happened in the portfolio of somebody else. These men were the most powerful individuals in the country, and yet they have spent the last 25 odd years arguing complete ignorance. Now, if the people that sat on the subcommittees of the State Security Council say they know nothing that happened, then I think it would be quite extraordinary to imagine that that they were only dealing with municipal affairs. That's what they're suggesting they were doing. And so I think it's for us to recognize, as you say, that this culture of impunity when it comes to the abuse of power, to pillage, to the way in which that women and children are treated, the issues of economic crime in our state go back far. And this is not an absolution for anyone who commits those kind of crimes today. Far from it.
Yeah.
I think they are continuing this wretched legacy in their practices. And that's precisely why I think the work of exposing, of dealing with, of prosecuting these networks, whether they are from apartheid or they are, what is happening presently, is so crucial to the functions of our state and the work of investigative journalists and writers.
Absolutely. And of course, one of the things that is quite frightening is that there was obviously an attempt, and Marian Tam confirms this, that there was an appeal for people to come forward with information, particularly people who were abused, who were afraid to come, who were paid off. And then, of course, the belief by Mr. Minnie that there were still very powerful people around that would go to great lengths to silence them. And we saw in the report, Baron du Plessis, the former finance minister, already saying that if you think I'm the living minister that is around, it's not me, I deny it, vehemently. And the point that you're making about how the NPA goes about, surely Mr. Baron du Plessis must be called in for questioning. Surely Mr. de Klerk must be called in for questioning. Mr. Derek Keyes must be called in for questioning. Every minister that served during that period should be asked to account, and of course to ask what they remember. People like Ruth Meyer, people like Martinus van Schalkwyk, these were people that were there. These rumors were around. What is the kind of forum that one constitutes to get these people to actually come and tell the truth?
I mean, as you say, some of them, and the Pit Boetas and the others like Derek Keyes, the former Minister of Finance for some time, he has since passed away. And I think the importance is that many of them are elderly people, and it's important for the prosecuting authority and the Hawks to act with some vigor around these matters. And yeah. There's a special unit within the prosecuting authority headed by Advocate Tori Pretorius. I think it's one of the great shames of our democracy, of how this unit seems to have failed our country, of not dealing with any of the serious crimes that the TRC, in fact, mandated it to do. And I've often heard Dr. Pretorius and others argue, Advocate Pretorius, that they are on these matters. Well, we've seen almost no evidence of this 20 years later. And frankly, I'm not certain what the women and men who work in that unit are doing or what they're being paid for by the state to do, but they certainly don't seem to be uncovering many of these truths that they should be doing. I think it's crucial that whoever's appointed by the president and hopefully in a more open process to head the National Prosecuting Authority is meeting with the Hawks, that there's a process of actually opening some of these matters up in the same way that we need to be dealing with a whole range of crimes that have not been dealt with, and that this is not something that has to, these kind of crimes, we should not immediately go to say we need a commission of inquiry, we need an expensive process that will peter out towards the end, we need a cover-up like the Cerruti Commission into the arms deal. What we need is for the state to flex its muscle, but to use the rule of law in the interest of the public. And in this instance, If there is clear evidence that the police and others are able to bring together, based hopefully on cooperation that they might get from people who are witnesses, who may themselves have been victims, and of course from others who have researched these matters, then I think there's only one way to deal with it, and that is for us to use our system of the rule of law, the courts, to be able to deal with this process. But I think the real danger is what happens is this matter continues to languish in the public mind as another example of why certain people are beyond the long arm of the law. And this is precisely this kind of action,
yes,
which I fear fuels impunity by various elites. I think we as a public need to demand action.
Absolutely, Mr. Van Vieren, thank you very much. We've run out of time. That is, of course, the director of Open Secrets, also author of Apartheid, Guns and Money, Henny Van Vieren, sketching the background of the time, the power that was wielded, the impunity, but more importantly, the need for justice to finally, see the light of day, and the need for us to use the rule of law to bring people to account. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we speak with longtime journalist and editor of Newsweek magazine, Martin Valtz, who, of course, is very familiar with the issue and, of course, was part of investigating the so-called suicides of people like Mr. Wiley at the time.
702. You're with 702. Your number one news and talk station.
It is 29 minutes after 9 o'clock. We continue our conversation looking into the death of one of the co-authors of the book Bird Island, and of course the book called The Lost Boys, rather, of Bird Island, that exposed the official cover-up of a paedophile ring involving former apartheid ministers, Minister of Defence at the time, Magnus Malan, and three National Party cabinet ministers and a prominent businessman. This time round, I'm joined by Martin Valtz. He's a journalist and editor of Newsweek magazine. Mr. Valtz, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Karima.
Now, Mr. Valtz, you, of course, have been a journalist for a very, very, very long time.
A very long time.
You've been around for long. You saw the piece that Marian Tam wrote today saying Mr. Mini feared for his life. I'm not sure if you've read the book, but there's been questions raised in the book around whether Mr. Wiley and Mr. Allen actually committed suicide. What can you tell us about the way in which these matters were reported at the time? Because many journalists that I've contacted said to me they can speculate because there were rumors, it was like kind of open secrets, that were around at the time. What did you know as a journalist at the time? How was this matter covered? And how did the officials in the National Party respond at the time?
I have to say right up front, it's a hell of a long time ago. So I can't remember fine detail, and I haven't actually been able to, in the time available, access the old cuttings of the stories I wrote at the time.
Yeah.
So I'm talking very much from memory, and memory sometimes fails.
Yeah.
But the things I can remember was I actually went to Port Elizabeth at very shortly after after Alan committed suicide,
right,
or was found dead on the beach.
Mm.
And I knew his brother, Jeff, very well, who was a fellow journalist on the Sunday Times for many years. So I had access to Jeff and his views of what had happened. My impression of, there were some questions, there were some, but the one detail I remember now, that there was a question of actually Alan having left a letter which disappeared, never to be seen. And it is true that he was obviously very troubled, had spent many hours on the beach, had made phone calls, not always known to whom. This is pre-cell phone days.
Mm.
And but that he faced court proceedings in the few days thereafter, it might even have been the following day, or certainly within days, when various of these teenage boys whom he had been involved in molesting or whatnot had laid charges, and he was about to be prosecuted in the Port Elizabeth courts. So I think it is not unfair to assume that he may well have committed suicide. What is of greater interest is he was the son of a military man, of a commander in the South African Navy.
Mm.
So there was definitely a sort of a familiarity with the military establishment and, you know, military style of life, if you like, which might explain why he had a connection with Magnus Malon.
Right.
The other thing which is interesting is that although he was mostly in Port Elizabeth and John Wiley lived in Cape Town and was a member of the cabinet, I don't know how they got together, but it was a long-standing relationship to the extent that it was recorded on two subsequent openings of Parliament. It was tradition that when after the opening of Parliament, there was a cocktail party at Parliament for members of the cabinet, and they were allowed to bring a guest.
Mm.
And on two occasions, Wiley brought Dave Allen as his guest.
Mm.
So that was point number one. Point number two, Wiley was obviously leading a very stressful double life.
Right.
And had become addicted to an antidepressant called Ativan.
Mm.
And the story I did at the time, which I picked up fairly quickly, at that stage I was actually working for Rapport in Cape Town. And I'd got a tip off and started following the track and discovered that any number of doctors were giving him prescriptions for Ativan without reference to others, including without any consultation. The then Minister of Health, if you can believe it, Dr. Van Niekerk, admitted to having given
Mr. Wiley
these drugs. I also tracked down various chemists where he was picking up these pills. The most famous one of them was a pharmacist called Mr. Black, who worked for White's Pharmacy, two blocks down from Parliament, and who confirmed that he was getting prescriptions from various doctors, and all carelessly, of course, dispensing these drugs. So there was an imbalance. And then, of course, the stories after Alan's suicide.
Right.
And journalists like myself asking questions.
Mm.
One of the things I did in Port Elizabeth was I was told to contact and did contact the lighthouse keeper opposite Bird Island.
Mm.
There was no telephone connection to Bird Island at the time. Again, I say it's pre-cell phones and there was no line there, but there was radio contact from the lighthouse.
Mm.
And the lighthouse keeper confirmed to me that a bunch of kids from Uitenhage had arrived at the lighthouse young teenage kids and demanded that he send a message to the men on Bird Island who had arrived by helicopter. And this was the famous gathering of Baron Duplessis and Magnus Malone and Johannesburg businessman. Alan was there, of course, and a Johannesburg businessman called Hans Benecke. I don't know if there were other people, but they were flown in by helicopter. They were collected by... Anyway, these kids demanded from the lighthouse keeper that he must tell them they must come and pay them certain sums of money, or otherwise they were going straight to the police to lay charges.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a sort of a extortion, blackmail situation, but definitely a confirmation that there was something improper going on involving the people on the island at that time.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the lighthouse keeper confirmed that this is what happened. Nobody came. He wasn't aware whether they had been paid or not. There's a distinct possibility that the self-same kids were the ones that then went and laid charges against Alan.
Yes.
Okay, so there was that much confirmation that some... Of course, it was extremely difficult.
Yes.
How could one conceivably report in those days... Quite apart from, let's say, anxieties about the authority or the power of the people you're reporting about, that never particularly fazed me in my career, I have to tell you. But how to make it stand up? I had no direct witness to anything. I knew that Alan had been involved. I had no proof that any of the other people on Bird Island, other than that these kids had threatened them via the lighthouse keeper.
Now, what is interesting, of course, is that Mr. Minnie gets involved after one of these children end up in hospital because he was a gun was put up in his anus and he was shot. And, of course, this is how Mr. Minnie gets onto the case to begin with. And as you say, Alan was facing charges. How does it happen that Mr. Wiley also commits suicide? Because Mr. Minnie and Mr. Stain... suggests in the book, certainly, that their suicides are possibly questionable, particularly if you look at the bodies. And we know, of course, Mr. Minnie left South Africa, went to go and live in China, felt that his life was in danger, didn't want much publicity around the book, only came and did one book appearance. And, of course, Mr. Stain not wanting to even talk about the issue at the moment. Are you thinking that there are still people that are prepared to kill, prepared to eliminate, prepared to threaten people that would be exposing what happened so many years ago?
I have absolutely no doubt, because you must imagine paedophilia is a sexual identity profile, which unfortunately leads the victim, if you like, because in a certain sense the paedophile is a victim, but is driven to being sexually involved with minors, which is a very serious crime because it's very damaging to the minors that they get involved with. So it's a crime, but at the same time, as I say, it is a certain percentage of the population are going to be like they are homosexual or bisexual or whatever the scale of sexual orientation might be, they're going to be a certain percentage who are, in fact, pedophiles.
Mm.
So it's a question of whether they practice or not, and if they do, we know, because it is such a serious crime with such serious penalties, the secrecy involved and the networks that develop are really forms of mafia.
Mm.
And the other thing is... They tend to be domineering.
Yes.
Because that's one of the reasons why they go for children. Mm. They are domineering.
It's a power issue.
It's a power issue. They can be extremely aggressive. In the homosexual community, you will hear reports of the so-called macho gays or whatnot who are rapists. They actually rape these juveniles. So this matches the sort of case history that are now sort of emerging from the shadows here. When you talk about a gun being used and so on, and it also fits the military and the police and the fireman profile. These are supposedly macho professions, but hidden in them are these deviants, and they are dangerous. Now, the next thing I wanted to say was Wiley obviously was leading a seriously double life, had ambitions in politics, had made it into the cabinet, was a very active campaigner for membership of the party and so on. But suddenly the party had turned against him. Clearly, the stories around him were becoming too dangerous. They were bubbling to the surface, and he was a threat or anything that might be exposed. I think the party, the National Party, were trying to put distance between themselves and Wiley. And the conclusion I came to at the time, and as I say, my memory is not strong enough that I can relate to you the detail on which I based it, but I can tell you the conclusion I arrived at is Wiley was desperate to be nominated again for the National Party as candidate in the Fishhook or Simonstown constituencies, which were considered safe for him. And but the party was hesitating, wasn't actually nominating him, and he was frantically trying to campaign and so on, and it was getting very close to the deadline. And one of the critical things that happened is on the night he committed suicide, he committed suicide quite late in the night, he made a last long telephone call. Now, that was very substantially established, that he was on the telephone for a long time. And the conclusion I came to on the basis of circumstantial evidence was that it was P.W. Botha, or at least his equivalent, where he was trying to plead his case and where he was told finally and categorically he was not going to be, they were going to disown him. And I think it's very shortly after that phone call that he committed suicide. Within a relatively short time, the police and other people arrived, I believe probably intelligence. And the first thing they did was they cleared our documents. And the second thing is we never were allowed to know who the last phone call was made to.
So the entire crime scene was sanitized, essentially?
Yes, the site was sanitized. There was an inquiry before a magistrate of Simonstown. That file was eventually made available to me. I was able to detail quite a lot of what went on, and especially his drug addiction and so on. That all became very obvious. So again, I don't think he was necessarily murdered, but I think he was driven to suicide. I think the world had closed in, and all his friends and the powerful around him, you know, had made clear to him that he was on his own. And so I think it's not unreasonable to think that he might have committed suicide. I don't have all the forensic evidence, so I can't tell you that he didn't commit suicide or that he was murdered. But everything seemed to indicate that he had committed suicide, but under very extraordinary circumstances, that there was no doubt.
But of course, the big issue is that there was certainly a cover-up on the context of the issues that people were involved in. I just want to correct myself. I kept on saying Mr. Stain, and of course, Chris is Miss Stain. So that is the one correction. My colleague, Eusebius McKaiser, just reminded me, and I was saying to him that that was my original understanding because I saw a picture, but a lot of the newspapers got it wrong and kept on referring to a mister. So my apologies to Ms. Stain, and she's of course critical to this book because she's a co-author, and independently of Mr. Miniad, of course, also investigated the matter as a journalist, but was eventually also hounded out of her profession. One of the other things, of course, also, Martin, that we need to be careful about is paedophilia isn't homosexuality, and people who are homosexuals are not paedophiles. So I think it's important to make that distinction as well. And what happened on Bird Island, in terms of certainly what is in the book, is that what you had was a paedophile ring. This wasn't adult men who were involved in consensual sex.
This was actually
abuse and rape of children against their will, and minors to that effect.
These are legal definitions that go along a scale. because, as I say, there among paedophiles, there are those that go for, you know, 5- and 6-year-olds, and those that go for 9- and 10- and 11-year-olds, and those that go for 14-, 15-, and 16-year-olds. So as I say, it's a complex situation, and I'm sure there are politics involved, and I'm not trying to be offensive to anybody. I'm just trying to be factual. So I mean, these boys that they appear to have been involved in were early teens.
Mm.
You know, so on. So it becomes borderline.
Yeah. Okay. What I wanted to ask you, Martin, I mean, it was obviously an extraordinary time. It was in a time of a state that was essentially an illegal state that was being propped up. It was beginning to go bankrupt. But it was also the height of the securocrats in the National Party, state security and so on. What efforts were made? I mean, you were talking about, for example, getting to, you know, Alan's brother. You found very detailed information about the mental health of someone like Mr. Wiley. But what efforts were made by journalists to find these children, to get their stories? How difficult was it? Because my understanding was that many of the boys were in fact coloured. Did that play a role in the fact that people didn't perhaps think it was important enough to get these children's versions? Were they scared? Were they paid off? Was it hard to get to them? Why did so few journalists try and get to the kids that were in fact abused and affected?
I can't answer that. I have to tell you, I mean, I wasn't based in Port Elizabeth, and I can't even remember from where I went to Port Elizabeth. My guess is I was still in Johannesburg, but I can't swear to that. So I was literally there for perhaps 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
So I couldn't try and find people whose names I didn't even know,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was told that they came from Uteneg, the ones that that had arrived at the lighthouse.
Yeah.
But it's a big world, and how do you start looking for people you don't know, you know, whatnot, and certainly, you know, you can't look at the telephone book, and who do you ask?
Yeah.
So with my resources were not such that I could hang around, and I wasn't even able in the time available to go to the courts to look for those court files that were going to be functioning if he'd actually appeared in court.
Mm.
My suspicion, of course, is that those files would have also been removed.
No, in fact, we see in the article written by Marianne Tam that says that the article were the dockets were removed on the instruction, no less, of P.W. Botha himself. And of course, that you know, there was a severe intervention. Let me read to you. It says, at the weekend, the Report newspaper confirmed that former state president P.W. Botha had personally called in March 1987 for Minnie's docket relating to Malan, Wiley and Allen to be removed from Minnie's office in P.E. A retired colonel who did not wish to be identified confirmed the removal of the docket to the writer Herman Janssen. He said that P.W. Botha had ordered Brigadier Ernie Schnettler, the divisional commissioner in Port Elizabeth, to get the docket on his desk at 7:30 the following morning. And Marianne says her last communication with Minnie was last week when he asked her advice about a journalist who had wanted to interview him. And then she said, when I reminded him that the WhatsApp was from her and that it might not have shown up on the message, he replied, my phone does show your name, to which I replied, you are a good cop. Minnie responded with a laughing emoji. Now, Mr. Minnie himself, of course, was also a very tortured man. I'm not sure if you've read the book. He certainly experienced his own trauma when he was a young person. And he was very committed to making sure that these stories come out and that people be held accountable. But he came under severe pressure, Mr. Valtz.
No, I understand that. But by the way, the story you've just told, of course, tallies with the thought that the last call that Wiley made was to P.W. Botha.
Mm.
It was clearly functioning at that absolutely the highest level. You can imagine, had that story come out, the impact it would have had on the National Party's own supporter base.
Yeah.
You know, so it was something they could not afford to allow. And I'm quite certain, at the very least, P.W. Botha would have told Wiley, you're on your own, you know, and we want nothing to do with you and whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the pressures must be enormous. And by the way, I mean, let's face it, we know that the politicians of that time and the authorities were not afraid to kill their enemies.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I mean, you know, we had the police hit squads, which I was perhaps the first journalist to actually encounter. I actually encountered Dirk Coetzee in 1983 already.
Yeah, bringing him to the fray of Jeugdblad eventually.
Short photo him, which leads to a longer history. But there were cases. I mean, I had a case where a South African businessman, and I name him unashamedly, called Jenkins, who ran a sort of a money smuggling system, moving ship containers and tankers offshore, selling them, you know, and as a means of getting money out of the country.
Right.
And he, for some obscure reason, enjoyed the protection of members of the National Party cabinet at the time.
Mm.
Anyway, when Jenkins was threatened with exposure by his British accountant, he hired two South African policemen or ex-policemen as hitmen.
Yeah.
To travel to England, and they murdered the accountant. His body was never found. They came back. You have no idea the lengths to which the South African Reserve Bank, went to cover for Mr. Jenkins and prevent any court hearing, even in England. The South African Reserve Bank sent lawyers to London to intervene in a case where they were trying to try one of these hitmen.
Yeah.
So for some reason, which nobody has properly fathomed, if you like, it was extraordinary to what extent certain elements of the National Party at high level were prepared to condone any level of crime, including murder, to cover for themselves.
Absolutely. Mr. Vals, a final question, if you like. And I asked this to Mr. Van Vieren as well. How does the National Prosecuting Authority and the police, the Hawks, the specialized units, go about dealing with this matter? Who are the people that should be interviewed? Who are the people that should be called in? How do we get to justice? How do we use the rule of law to bring these people to book? I mean, the book speaks about one minister that is still alive, Baron du Plessis, saying over the weekend in Rapport openly that he wants to deny that he is that minister. You mention him as being one of the people on the island when the boys went to the lighthouse and demanded that the person there contact the men on the island for payment. Who should be brought together for? Who should be answerable? Who should be brought in for questioning? How does the law enforcement agencies go about bringing justice to this case?
You know, it is such a difficult question because, I mean, I've been campaigning, for 20 years. For instance, I tried to persuade Jill Marcus, when she was still a member of Parliament, and various other members of Parliament, that they must actively go looking for the records, the financial records of these things at Volkskas. The Volkskas had a so-called geheime kamer, or secret room. We had evidence that it existed. The Reserve Bank had voluminous records of all the illicit financial transactions with regard to arms and any number of other dirty dealings. Those were supposed to be searched and seized and used as evidence. They never did. In fact, Jill Marcus ends up as the governor of the Reserve Bank. Everybody was bought off one way or another.
Mm.
So time has gone by. The people are dead. The witnesses are dead. The documents are gone. You know, one almost, I mean, I think, you know, it might be worth pursuing one or two symbolic cases as just symbolic respect for, you know, the victims.
Yes.
But on the whole, I think one has to call history history. And really, we need to start dealing with the current situation, that we're not ending up with a repeat of history.
I think the point is that we have the current situation precisely because we never actually dealt with what came before.
Absolutely. And I'm not only talking about politicians. I'm talking about business people. It's a free-for-all in South Africa because of the total collapse of law enforcement.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't use the label white monopoly capital because it's a dangerous one to use, and it has a very heavy racist element to it. But the truth of the matter is big business is getting away with near damn it murder in the sense of, you know, what they get away with in terms of theft and avoidance of tax and all these antisocial behaviors.
And I think that's why the new elite, particularly a large section of them, believe that they want to do what whites did. And that's, of course, the essential moral, barrenness and dearth that exists in our country. Our moral compass is really broken.
I'm not talking about black businessmen.
What I'm saying, Mr. Valt, is that
white establishment business.
Exactly. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that a lot of people who use the rhetoric of radical economic transformation wants to use the equivalence. Whites did it, why can't we do it? And I think that is the fundamental straw man argument that is there. We should, of course, hold ourselves to a higher standard, and that of course is encapsulated in our constitution. Mr. Martin Valt, thank you so very much for your time. That is of course long time journalist and editor of Newsweek magazine, giving us a taste of what it was like to investigate the stories at that time and giving us some really fascinating insight into the mental state of Mr. Mark Wiley, a rising star at the time in the National Party, Minister for Environmental Affairs, but clearly living a double life and eventually being found dead, said to have committed suicide.